Hello, I'm Maria Titizian.
And I'm Rubina Margosyan, and this is The Week in Review.
Every week, we bring you the stories shaping Armenia and the region.
From politics and policy to social issues and conflict, we break down the news and what it means for you.
This week in the news, Azerbaijan renews accusations against the Armenian military and puts forward fresh demands for a peace agreement. Local elections in Armenia's second largest city spark controversy, and Artsakh Armenians stage a major rally in Yerevan, voicing concerns over their uncertain future. These stories and more in our weekly roundup of the news.
This week, Azerbaijan renewed its accusations against the Armenian armed forces, claiming ceasefire violations. Armenia's defense ministry swiftly denied the allegations, stating instead that Azerbaijani forces had opened fire on villages in Armenia's southern Sunik region. According to a statement released on March 31, Azerbaijani troops targeted the village of Khanzoresk, damaging a residential home. No casualties were reported. The defense ministry reiterated that the Armenian government had previously proposed establishing a joint mechanism to investigate ceasefire violations, an initiative to which Azerbaijan has yet to respond. Yerevan also reaffirmed this week its readiness to view any concrete evidence presented by Baku to support its claims of ceasefire violations. At the same time, it called on Azerbaijan to investigate the shelling incident in Khanzoresk and provide a public clarification.
Meanwhile, speaking during parliamentary hearings at the French National Assembly, French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot said the new conditions being put forward by Azerbaijan are delaying the signing of a peace treaty. He described Baku's demands as unacceptable, also noting that France is closely monitoring the situation of Armenian prisoners unlawfully detained in Baku and reiterated Paris's call for their release as part of the broader peace process. Baku was quick to respond. Azerbaijani Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ayhan Hajizadeh rejected Barrot's remarks, stating that the issues in question have been on the negotiating table for more than 2 years and are not new. He said if France genuinely supports the early signing of a peace agreement, it should instead be encouraging Armenia to take what he called appropriate steps. As for calls to release Armenians detained in Azerbaijan, Hajizadeh insisted that these individuals are accused or convicted of serious crimes, including war crimes, ethnic cleansing, military aggression, and torture, and that Azerbaijan has every right to investigate and prosecute such cases. He went further, calling on France to address what he described as political persecution, police brutality during protests, and systemic corruption within its own political institutions, particularly in relation to its colonial legacy, before criticizing Azerbaijan's judicial proceedings. And this seems to be, Baku's, line with France, continually reminding them of their own domestic issues and colonial history.
And this week, the EU Special Representative for the South Caucasus, Magdalena Krono, visited Armenia. She met with Prime Minister Pashinyan, Foreign Minister Mirzoyan, and Security Council Secretary Armen Grigoryan. The discussions focused on Armenia-Azerbaijan relations, particularly the signing of the finalized peace agreement. Krono emphasized the importance of this agreement, expressing confidence that it would play a key role in securing long-term peace and stability in the region. The meeting also touched on the continued development of Armenia-EU relations, as well as humanitarian concerns, including the fate of missing persons and the return of Armenian prisoners of war and detained civilians.
This week, German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier was in Armenia and Azerbaijan. Although largely ceremonial role, this was the first time a German president visited either country since independence. Steinmeier arrived in Armenia on March 30, where he met with President Vahagn Khachaturian and Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. During his visit, he also traveled to the Sunik region and met with the European observers, the EUMA. The German president stressed Berlin's respect for Armenia's decision to begin EU membership talks, calling it a bold step. He acknowledged that much work remains to be done, especially in terms of reforms. He also noted that there is a realistic understanding in Armenia that the road to EU membership will be long. However, Steinmeier highlighted that strengthening Armenia's ties with the EU will contribute to its economic growth. The German president also spoke about Armenia-Azerbaijan relations, emphasizing the importance of both countries taking the final steps toward conflict resolution and establishing peace. He commended Armenia for its constructive stance in recent weeks, stating that there are no more open questions in the peace agreement. According to Steinmeier, nothing now stands in the way of a treaty or an agreement, peace agreement being signed, ratified, and implemented. He noted that Armenia has made the decisions needed to make peace possible, and now it's time for Azerbaijan to remove any remaining doubts.
After Yerevan, he traveled to Baku, where he met with his Azerbaijani counterpart, and during their talks, he emphasized the great importance of finalizing negotiations between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and expressed hope that the peace agreement will be signed soon, but also noted that the preconditions set by Azerbaijan should not become an obstacle to achieving lasting peace between the two nations. While President Ilham Aliyev told the German president that once Armenia addresses these issues, where there will be no obstacles in signing the peace treaty. If Armenia is genuinely committed to finalizing the agreement, it must accept what Aliyev called Azerbaijan's legitimate conditions. And these conditions were the ones that we have been talking about forever, dissolving the OSCE Minsk group and
pulling all international legal claims, mutual legal claims from international courts. I mean, there's more. I mean, removing third-party forces from the border, from the state border. I mean, there's one more
coming this week that's kind of been recycled again.
This week, Baku, as you mentioned, Rubina, once again raised the issue of landmine maps. Azerbaijan's National Assembly called on the international community to pressure Armenia into providing what it calls accurate and comprehensive landmine data. The call came after Foreign Ministry spokesperson, again, Hajizadeh, told the Turkish Envoy magazine that Azerbaijan has made humanitarian demining in Qarabagh and East Zangezur region one of its priorities, claiming that despite repeated calls on Armenia, both before and after the 2020 war, to provide accurate landmine maps, Armenia has failed to do so. He added that the maps provided to Azerbaijan under international pressure cover only a small portion of mined areas and were just 25% accurate. He also stated that while Armenia's maps indicate around 400,000 landmines, the actual number, according to the Azerbaijani side, is closer to 1.5 million landmines. He called this yet another setback to peace efforts and confidence building between the two countries. Hajizadeh stressed that accurate maps are essential to allow internally displaced persons to return and for reconstruction to take place. It's interesting, right? They hadn't been talking about the landmine maps for, I would venture to say, about a year and a half or 2 years.
Almost,
and now,
yes.
Now that, again, they're digging up more sort of conditions.
We should go back and look into all the narratives that have been used and see what to expect next also. Yeah.
Well, back in December of 2023, the two sides had made a deal to take tangible steps to build trust. So this was on December 7, 2023. 6 days later, 32 Armenian captives were repatriated. Then on January 26, 2024, Armenia handed over 8 new minefield maps. Azerbaijan dismissed them as inaccurate. Armenia responded that those were the best quality maps available and that all relevant information in its possession had already been shared with Baku.
And today, Eric Jacobs, a senior advisor at the U.S. State Department Bureau of Energy Resources, said that President Trump is looking forward to the signing of what he called a long-awaited peace treaty between Armenia and Azerbaijan. This happened when he was speaking at an energy forum in Baku, and Jacobs said such an agreement would mark the beginning of a new era of security and prosperity for the South Caucasus region.
Meanwhile, the trials of former Artsakh officials and other Armenian detainees continues in Baku. This week, Rupen Vartanian's lawyer, Jared Genzer, told the Christian news agency. Now, the wording is kind of a little strange here, but he said that the Trump administration told his team that the freedom of Armenian prisoners must be a precondition for President Trump to ultimately endorse a peace deal. In a roundabout way, saying that the release of Armenian prisoners has to be part of any peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan. This is our interpretation of it. Genzer also pointed out that during his 2024 campaign, Trump had pledged to stand up for persecuted Armenian Christians. He stressed the significance of the issue, noting that if a peace agreement moves forward without resolving the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh and the Armenian Christian prisoners of war, it could mean the sacrifice of these prisoners as part of the deal.
So also because in the interview, he goes on to say that no dictator just releases any prisoners right. unless the price of keeping the prisoners is higher than releasing them. So that's basically his also kind of explanation there. And in other news, Armenia's foreign ministry confirmed this week that it won't be contributing to the collective budget of the CSTO this year. This follows Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan's announcement last February, where he stated that Armenia has frozen its membership to the Russian-led security organization. Shortly after, Yerevan announced that it would be suspending contributions to the CSTO budget. And around a month ago, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin warned that if Armenia fails to make its budgetary payment by the end of 2025, the other member states could consider expelling Armenia from the organization. And although the CSTO budget and contributions from member states are typically not made public, last year the Russian representative to the organization, Viktor Vasilyev, shared that Russia covers 50% of the budget, with the remaining 50% divided among the other five member states. He also mentioned that Armenia's share for 2025 was set at 10%, while the specific ruble amount for Armenia's contribution wasn't disclosed. Media reports indicate that for 2024, it would have been approximately $700,000 for Armenia.
And despite ongoing tensions surrounding Armenia's membership in the CSTO, relations between Yerevan and Moscow appear to be warming. Let's put it that way. Foreign Minister Ararat Mirzoyan and Sergei Lavrov exchanged messages, marking the 33rd anniversary of diplomatic relations. Mirzoyan highlighted the importance of continued cooperation amid a shifting international landscape, stressing Armenia's commitment to long-term mutually beneficial ties across political, economic, and humanitarian spheres. Lavrov reaffirmed that despite external pressures aimed at weakening the alliance, Russia and Armenia have maintained strong political dialogue and growing economic collaboration. Moscow remains committed to deepening the partnership in the interests of both nations and regional stability in the South Caucasus.
And a parliamentary delegation from Vietnam arrived in Armenia this week during talks between Armenia's parliament speaker Alain Simonian and his Vietnamese counterpart. The sides discussed strengthening of bilateral relations. Economic ties between the two countries were also on the agenda, both sides agreeing on the importance of developing concrete steps to boost trade and investment. At the end of the meeting, the sides signed an agreement on cooperation between the national assemblies of the two countries.
You know, in all these years that I've been reporting, I don't recall
a Vietnamese delegation.
So, yeah, it was interesting. And in other news, Armenia is now part, speaking of relations, part of a list of countries facing new tariffs imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump. Starting on April 5, a 10% import tax will be applied to goods coming from Armenia as well as Georgia and Azerbaijan. This tax is reciprocal. So the U.S. reciprocated the taxes which were already in place against their exports to foreign countries. Armenia's main exports to the U.S. include alcohol, carpets, diamonds, precious and semi-precious stones and metals, and aluminum. But it's mainly and particularly the diamond sort of industry the diamonds that are being exported to the U.S. Last year, total trade between Armenia and the U.S. reached $410 million, making up less than 1.5% of Armenia's overall trade turnover. And there is a trade imbalance here. Armenia imports much more than it exports. And now with these new tariffs, and look what's happening to global markets because of the tariffs.
It's us and everyone else in the same boat. Well, in an ongoing story about what's happening in Gyumri and who will
local
be the mayor,
local
elections. On March 30, snap municipal elections were held in Gyumri, Armenia's second largest city, and in the small town of Parakar. This is just outside of Yerevan. In Gyumri, while civil contract secured first place with 36% of the votes, this isn't enough for them to elect their candidate, Sadik Minasyan, as mayor. This is without support from other parties. Former Gyumri mayor Vartan Gukasyan and the Communist Party, because he was running under the Communist Party.
Yes,
we might have a communist mayor in Gyumri, came in second with 20% of the votes, followed by the Our City Alliance, led by Martun Grigoryan from the I Have Honor parliamentary faction, with 15.5% of the votes. Ruben Mkhitaryan's My Strong Community Party came in fourth with 7.9%, and businessman Garen Simonian, representing the Mother Armenia Alliance, got 6.1%. Well, following the elections, Garen Simonian and Ruben Mkhitaryan announced their support for Rukasyan's mayoral bid. Today, Martun Grigoryan, who holds the deciding vote, announced that he will provide the necessary seats for Rukasyan, essentially paving the way for him to be elected as mayor of Gyumri. The Central Electoral Commission has yet to announce the allocation of seats in the city council. This will become clear once votes from parties and alliances that didn't pass the threshold are redistributed.
Well, in the meantime, we have to talk about Vartan Rugasyan.
It could be a whole separate podcast, Maria.
It could be like it has to be said moment, right? Like righteous, I don't know. Okay, so Vartan Rugasyan, a controversial figure in Armenia's political landscape, primarily in Gyumri, where he has served as mayor many, many years. He is facing new criminal charges alongside accusations of illegally appropriating property and privatizing land plots in Gyumri. He now faces charges for coercing people to participate in his campaign rallies. Just days before the elections, an audio recording surfaced in which Rugasyan is allegedly heard discussing plans to organize a meeting with workers from one of Gyumri's markets. He reminds them that he had once provided them with booths, stalls, whatever, which they were still using to support their families. The recording includes offensive language and harsh expressions.
When we first saw this footage, Maria, you and I both thought that it was from 20 years ago.
Yes.
Well,
it wasn't.
Right after the elections, Vartan Rugasyan found himself at the center of yet another controversy. Well, this was during a briefing with reporters when he made, unacceptable reports, like inflammatory remarks, claiming that
disgusting, maybe.
Well, he was saying, how could he not be sinning when girls were exposing their
bare legs
and...
I'm sorry.
Well, basically,
it's pretty disgusting.
He also went on to a comment about the LGBTQ community because he was asked to if he would tolerate a parade. And his response was that if anything like a gay marriage would take place, he would shoot the priest in church. And I don't know, they're not being tolerated, these kinds of statements, because there is so much condemnation and people are speaking up and organizations are speaking up. And the Helsinki Committee of Banazor has filed
a suit against him.
Against him for hate speech. Yet there's really no other way of...
Potentially dealing. It's so rooted. It's such a culturally deeply rooted issue that even though, yes, people like us are calling it disgusting or whatever, 20% of the voters in Gyumri voted for this man. This is not new. That's why, when you were saying we thought it was from 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, and it was just a few days ago, you and I are in shock. But let's look at, put a mirror up to ourselves and say, these things somehow, somewhere, are being perpetuated or
we're not in shock. I think we are at a point where we need to figure out how not to
be in shock. Sorry.
How to make sure that this is no longer acceptable.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know. And speaking of acceptable, unacceptable behavior, civil contract MP Vilen Gabrielian put down his mandate or resigned his seat following a controversial incident in Gyumri a day after the elections. It was on March 31. He appeared to be under the influence of alcohol. He didn't appear. He was. He used profanities while speaking to a journalist who approached him. And they were just goading him on. It was obvious he was drunk out of his mind. And they were, asking him questions. It was like trying to get him to speak. The situation escalated when later reporters tried to follow up with him, near Civil Contract's campaign headquarters, asking whether he planned to step down or apologize for the profanities that he used. That exchange also turned into a verbal altercation. Gabrielian apologized the next day in a Facebook message and announced that he was going to be resigning.
Yeah, I saw this in another video, another journalist in Yerevan at this point already, days after, asking him again about the same question. And he said, did you see that video? And what do you expect I would do? Like, there's no other recourse other than me resigning.
Right, right.
But however, other than resigning, he also in his resignation notes said that he'd be taking more active role in his parties, which is civil contract, the ruling civil contract, inner workings, because there's a lot to be done there and a lot to be fixed. And about, more briefly, about the other municipal election that took place in Armenia, in Parakar, the opposition Unity Bloc scored a decisive win, securing over 56% of the vote, enough to elect a mayor without forming a coalition. The ruling Civil Contract Party came in second with just over 31% of the vote, followed by the National Progress Party with 7.7%. Civil Contract had fielded Lutfi Gulnazarian, the former head of the Parakar community, who resigned back in November of 2024 amid a criminal investigation. The Unity Bloc is led by Valodia Grigorian, a member of the Country to Live party and current member of the Parakar Community Council. With their majority, the bloc is expected to elect Grigorian as mayor.
And in other news, General Movses Hagopian, the former chief of staff of the Armenian Armed Forces, is facing new criminal charges related to the supply of defective military equipment, ammunition, worth about $11 million from Russia. The high-ranking official is accused of official negligence, which led to significant property damage and other serious consequences. Hagopian is also facing charges in another criminal case for disclosing state secrets.
And on March 29, this was last Saturday, over 9,000 Artsakh Armenians gathered in Yerevan's Freedom Square, voicing concerns over the ongoing uncertainty surrounding their future. The key demands included the continuation of housing allowances for displaced families, the right to return, and a call to address the hate speech directed at Artsakh Armenians. Although throughout the week, protests took place with participants urging the government to maintain both the amount and the scope of rent assistance. They also criticized the inefficiency of housing and employment programs. And on April 3, following talks between representatives of the protesters and Deputy Prime Minister Narek Khachaturian, it was announced that rent assistance would not be reinstated. The protesters, however, vowed to continue fighting for their rights.
You were there, Rubina, during the protest. What was the mood like?
You know, we've gotten so used to angry protesters. It wasn't angry. It was somehow relatively silent crowd, even as big as it was. I mean, the Freedom Square was, and you could see, you could hear the Artsakh Armenian across everywhere you turned. I don't know. It was a little emotional for me, and also kind of considering that many of them had come from far away. Not everyone is in Yerevan, and.
Someone I know who was there said it was like you, he was very reflective and said it was almost as if they came to see one another more than anything else.
And we do have an article about the assistance provided and the housing situation. The government had said that eventually these rental subsidies will be phased out, and we're in the process of that.
And it's hard. It's hard. I mean, it's a year and a few months. Actually, almost a year and a half now.
And that's hardly enough time for anyone to land on their feet.
Absolutely. After losing everything. Yeah.
And that was one part of that, maybe the emotional state where you're seeing people greeting each other, but also you're realizing everyone lost everything. The amount of people who had lost everything, as much as we understand, as much as we repeat the numbers, as much as we say it, as much as we demand justice, just the sheer amount of people saying, like, this many people lost everything.
Yeah, then you're in the middle of them, yeah.
It was definitely very different to every other rally where you see provocateurs, you see different people, you see like this extra aggression, you almost see this performative behavior. None of that was there. And, you know, the format is interesting because they've been gathering and having public discussions and also public talks about their rights and the right of return with different experts. So kind of also that took me, not that I was there, but during 88,
yes,
the whole culture in Freedom Square, at Freedom Square, which wasn't
Freedom Square,
was that there would be public discussions and gatherings. And so it's almost turning into that from what I can understand at this point.
And speaking of Artsakh, this week marks 9 years. I can't believe it's been 9 years since the four-day war. In the early hours of April 2, 2016, Azerbaijan launched a large-scale offensive along the line of contact with Nagorno-Karabakh. At the time, it was the most intense escalation since the First Karabakh War of the 1990s. A Russian-mediated ceasefire halted the heavy fighting a few days later. The Armenian side suffered about 100 casualties, including both civilians and servicemen. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan claimed their losses did not exceed 40, though independent media at the time reported that that number was likely over 100. Artsakh also, there were territorial losses. It lost about 800 hectares of land and 21 outposts in the Talysh highlands in the area around the Arax River. Many view the April War as a precursor to the 2020 Artsakh War. I mean, it was. The signs were there. And anyway, so it's been a strange week in that respect. And as always, we talk about the articles that we published. And you mentioned Rubina. We issued published a piece by Hranush Dermoyan, a humanitarian aid to Artsakh Armenians, who stepped up. And she sort of goes through you know, the international aid agencies, different countries, the EU, the UN, what they pledged and provided, and with the US aid huge cut, I think it was just over 80% of cuts around the world, how that impacts Artsakh Armenians' humanitarian aid and what the Armenian government has done. And we since the ethnic cleansing, had periodically published sort of the aid programs that were available to them.
Well, if those of our listeners who survived are a bit about the part about Gyumri and how many percent they or didn't catch everything, we do have another piece by Hranush Dermoyan. Mm-hmm. It's called Municipal Elections, Opposition Wins in Parakkar, Uncertainty in Gyumri. It will be updated periodically as news. It's in our Newswatch section, and it's kind of a primer as to what happened, and we'll be updating as things continue happening.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, starting on May 1 of this year, Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union will a free trade agreement will come into effect. It's a piece by David Khachaturian. It's called What's in It for Armenia? The EAEU-Iran Free Trade Pact Explained. And, you know, he argues that this offers Armenia some economic opportunities, but also some geopolitical challenges. He unpacks the deal's benefits, risks, and implications, exploring Armenia's role as both a beneficiary and a strategic player in regional trade, because Armenia is the only country in the EAEU that has a direct border with Iran.
And another piece that is also a sum up of what's happening and will continue to happen, develop in one way or another, Smoke Signals or Political Will, Armenia's EU Membership Bill. It's a piece by Hovhannes Nazaretyan and basically looks into what supporters see as a step towards strengthening democracy, security, and economic well-being for Armenia by when the parliament ratified the bill on EU membership, and also talks about what the critics are saying, which is arguing that deeper ties with the EU were already progressing without such a declaration, and what does that declaration grant us?
Right. And this week I did a podcast with Nerses Kopalyan. He's the author of our monthly security report. It's called, as always, Examining the Context. And it's about Aliyev's performative gamble, the draft agreement on peace. That's what it's called. And basically we talk about what's in the security briefing. And that is why Aliyev basically will not sign a peace deal and why it's...
He initially agreed to declare that the text has been agreed upon, which is a very interesting take.
It really is. And so you can take a listen and you also read the security report. It is, it is a very interesting explainer as to why Armenia is making concessions. And why for Aliyev, the ultimate concession is the actual signing of a peace deal. And that's why he won't do it. So, interesting times, for lack of a better word. And that's the kind of week it's been here in Armenia. Thank you for listening. Have a safe and peaceful weekend. And we will be back again next week.